So today I'm going to talk about collapse models. So so yesterday you'll notice there weren't a great deal of equations. A lot of the arguments were very philosophical. Today we'll be back to having equations. So collapse models, this idea was initiated by Philip Pearl and also Garrardi, Rimini, and Weber, and I'm going to give you the so-called GLW version of things. But first of all, I'll give you some motivation as to why these models are interesting. So the motivation is to solve the measurement problem. We call it the reality problem. And to do this by explicitly modifying the evolution due to the Schrodinger equation. Modifying the evolution from that of the Schrodinger equation. And the idea is that this modification should be such that if you have small systems consisting of not too many quantum particles, then the modification hardly affects the evolution at all. Whereas for big systems, such as pointers and tables and chairs and so on, the evolution is strongly affected. So for small systems, the evolution is hardly affected. This means that superpositions persist. For big systems, the evolution is going to be strongly affected. So superpositions are very quickly suppressed. Superpositions of sort of macroscopically distinct states are quickly suppressed. Okay. So that's the sort of motivation for wanting to modify the evolution, the dynamics from that of the Schrodinger equation. A possible justification for doing this comes from thinking about how you might get a theory of quantum gravity. And these ideas have been considered by Diossi and Penrose. So here's the idea. Imagine we have some massive object. I think for Penrose and Diossi, massive means sort of at least as big as the Planck mass, or about the Planck mass. And now it goes into a superposition. So either it goes here or here. That could happen if it was if it was hit by a quantum particle from one of two directions, and that quantum particle was in a superposition. So if it goes here, then a new you'll have to establish a new solution for the metric and space-time geometry around this particle, because this is massive enough to induce changes in the metric. So on the other hand, if it goes here, then you'll have a different solution. So of course, we don't actually have a theory of quantum gravity, but you can imagine what the classical solution would be to the classical equations of general relativity in each of these two positions. And now Penrose points out there's kind of a problem, because when you have two different solutions like this in general relativity, there's no sensible way of mapping the two solutions onto each other. So identifying points in one solution, space-time points in one solution, and mapping them onto space-time points on another. So we have these two separate solutions, but there's no sensible way the reason for that is that each of these solutions is only really meaningful up to general coordinate transformations or diffeomorphisms. These solutions only have meaning up to such general coordinate transformations, and so it is meaningless to identify these points because they don't have any intrinsic meaning. The meaning is only really with respect to relational quantities in each of these two solutions. So that causes a problem, because if you want to think of this as a quantum state, a quantum superposition of these two situations, then you need something like a common foliation to give you a time parameter for each of these two solutions so you can evolve the state forward. But you don't have it because of this problem of identifying points. So then Penrose says, well, something has got to give when you have an inconsistency. Yes?
Sorry, I'm just wondering, and is a live argument as to whether or not the homeomorphically related solutions should be taken as distinct or not. Could this kind of consideration be taken as a reason to think that, in fact, a homeomorphism is a genuine physical process and those the homeomorphically related solutions are, in fact, distinct?
I suppose you could try to take that approach, but then the whole sort of framework of general relativity starts to look very bad. It really,
well,
really needs this idea.
The mathematical framework of general relativity precisely does treat the homeomorphisms as real because it has an underlying manifold and has individual points in manifold.
Sure, but the sort of then you have the problem that you have the whole argument. So you have the problem that then you lack determinism. That you have, I don't mean that you have probabilities. I mean that you lack the ability to find a unique solution. The equations don't give you a solution in any deterministic way. So the only way to solve that, Einstein's way to solve that, is to say, well, really, the physical solution is just the thing you have up to different morphisms.
Well, yes, but I mean, there are people who say it's not the right approach, and that we should.
Right. Okay.
The morphisms are genuine, in which case, this problem seems to go away.
I suppose that's true. I mean, that's not the standard sort of belief
in
general relativity, and Penrose is a general relativist. But you could try taking that approach, and then you wouldn't have such a serious problem here.
What is the whole problem?
The whole problem. So when you solve, it's worth taking. I mean, this is really more to do with the foundations of general relativity, but it's very interesting, and it exactly relates to this issue. So imagine you have some region of space. You have a manifold. You're finding a solution to Einstein's field equations, okay? And you're interested in the solution inside this region of the manifold. And we can imagine outside this region, we have as much information as we want about all the fields, okay? So enough information that it should provide sufficient boundary conditions to solve and give a solution inside here. And so then we can imagine we find a particular solution for the metric. We may have other fields as well, but we find some solution. Let's imagine we have no matter inside here, so it's just the metric. we find a solution, and it's consistent with the Einstein field equations. The only problem is those equations are invariant under general coordinate transformations. And you can find a transformation that leaves everything outside the hole unchanged. So it doesn't change x outside the hole, but it does change x inside the hole. So that will map you to another solution. So you can think of that as being a transformation on x, but because the equations are invariant, what you really have, you can then pull that, you can think of that as being back in the original system. You can think of it as being now a different solution. So you found two solutions inside the same region of space-time, and the equations don't tell you which one you should have. So that was a real problem, and Einstein was quite concerned about the whole program when he discovered this issue. There's a sort of breakdown of determinism in the sense that the equations don't determine a unique solution. And then finally he realized, or he came to the solution, that what you should do is, in terms of thinking about what the physically relevant stuff is inside this this region of space-time, you should just take sort of relational properties. So for example, if you have two particles, or three particles, say, that happen to coincide at a certain point, x, then under this coordinate transformation, that property will remain true. It will happen for a different value of x, but those sort of relational properties will remain true. So that's a way of solving this problem. And then, so that means mathematically you're modding out over the homeomorphisms. So the physical thing that you have is what you get after modding out over the different homeomorphism group. But the problem with that is it means that really the x itself has no intrinsic meaning. The only meaning really is in these relational properties, the thing that you have after modding out. So that's the problem over here. There's no way really of identifying points between these two different solutions. This is Penrose's argument. So Penrose says something's got to give. Except exactly says it more eloquently than that. And he says the thing that has to give is quantum theory, and this superposition has to collapse. So he doesn't have a constructive reason for saying that you have to have collapse. It's rather a consistency reason. He says, well, the thing is inconsistent, so the only way I can see to resolve it, says Penrose, is to assume that some collapse happens. And then he gives a sort of heuristic argument and comes up with an equation for how quickly this collapse happens. He says the collapse has got to happen on a time scale t, which is equal to h bar over e delta, and this is the gravitational self-energy difference between the two mass distributions. And to give an equation, it's so you integrate the difference. Well, this is the equation. So you have two distributions, and you can think of this as sort of corresponding to the sort of Newtonian potential. This is, if you take this, all the velocities involved to be low, then it's going to be something like this.
So this E with triangle is the gravitational self-energy difference.
What, sorry?
So the gravitational self...
The gravitational self-energy difference.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it doesn't really mean... This is just a sort of very heuristic argument he gives, and he ends up with an equation. His arguments actually get very heuristic when he looks at different ways of calculating this, because it really depends on how you define these density distributions. Because, you know, do you want it to be averaged at the level of the atoms or at the level of the nuclei? And he ends up talking about the level of the nuclei. So when he does these calculations, he needs to get into some detail as to what this really means. the important point is that there is a proposed time scale for this collapse coming from these very heuristic arguments. And D'Ossi has a similar equation. Okay, so that's the sort of a possible justification for why you should have a collapse mechanism like this. So now let me give you an explicit collapse model.
So, just based on this argument, why it matters how big the superposition is, like if there's an inconsistency, if it doesn't make sense to talk about a superposition, I don't understand why it matters the bigger or smaller superposition.
Or why it matters if the particles are bigger or smaller. I think. Why from here? Yeah. You could say. One argument is, well, this is true the moment you have the slightest difference, even for an electron.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Penrose addresses that, and then that's when he gets into this very heuristic reasoning, and he talks about, at least in one version, he talks about, well, it needs to be big enough to induce a one graviton difference. And I don't really understand exactly how he does that. So, yeah, he has to get into heuristics because he doesn't really have a proper theory here. Exactly, yeah. At that level, it would rule out any superposition, even for the smallest mass. So he has to, and he's aware of that, so he has to introduce some criteria, which in the original version has to do with having at least a graviton difference between the two situations.
Just a clarification question. The main idea is that for small systems and large systems, the evolution should be different.
Yep.
In this case, is the system size given by the mass?
Like a length scale. Yeah. In this case, the what you mean by big is how massive. Yeah. Okay. So, an explicit collapse model. And this is the one due to Girardi, Rimini, and Weber. In the presentation given by Bell, so this was 1, 9, 8, 6. And this is the presentation given by Bell in 1987. He gave a lecture on this at a conference to celebrate, I think, 100 years since Schrodinger's birth. He gave it at Imperial College, and I was an undergraduate there, so I actually saw him lecture. It's one of two occasions I saw him lecture. He died in 1990. It was. I didn't understand what he was talking about at the time. So let's start. One, the ontology. So first of all, there's a wave function. And it's state at time t. And then often there's a second part to the ontology, and this is a way to get local variables. I'll explain what I mean by this in a minute. And there's two ideas out there. Bell, in this 1987 paper, talks about the what's now called the flash ontology. And Girardi and co-workers talks about a mass density ontology. So let me explain what the issue is here. The issue is if your ontology is just the wave function, Well, that's something that exists in configuration space, whereas the world we see around us is a world that lives in three-dimensional space. So one approach to that is the approach I talked about yesterday, to pursue this sort of reasoning of David Wallace and Simon Saunders, that you get this emergent branching structure with classical worlds that seem to be well-defined in three-dimensional space. But that's not the kind of approach that these guys want to take. It's not, they don't want to take a, it's not a many-worlds approach. So instead, they want to point to something in the wave function, which some property of the wave function, which can be, which can give rise to some property in three-dimensional space. Okay. And there are two proposals, and I'll talk about them after I've given you the mathematics of this model. So that's the ontology. And then there's the dynamics.
What exactly is a beagle?
Oh, sorry, yeah, yeah. You use these terms and you forget. So a friend of mine, Joy Krishnan, was sitting on the bus next to John Bell when he was going to give a talk once, and he was trying to think of a new term for something. So the idea is, you know, this is something that, that exists locally. He's trying to think of a new word for it, you know, the sort of things that you, the things that are real, basically. And I think by the end of that conversation, he had the term isable, you know, things that, you know. And then I think he must have later on come up with the term beable. So it's sort of things that be, so to speak, beable. Yeah, and a local beable is something that is locally. Yeah, it's John Bell's. I mean, he.
Well,
yeah.
Then it's a sense of the word beable as something that is able to be.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You get so used to these words that you forget that. They're not just common words that you find in the dictionary. I don't think it's in the dictionary. Maybe it is by now.
So the things in the ontology are the beables?
The things in the local ontology are the local beables.
Okay.
So he always talked about local beables. There's also, this wave function is a very non-local thing. So it is, this something real. It's meant to be something real. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't contain a sort of, it doesn't contain an account of three-dimensional reality.
Right. Okay.
So then, the idea is to try and find some property of this, which you can use to extract an account of the three-dimensional world that we see around us. And then these are the local beables. I suppose you could also talk about beables in the general sense. And I suppose, and I'm not sure if Bell ever used the word beables by itself without putting local in front of them. But the natural interpretation would be that beables are the ontology, and then local beables are that part of the ontology that gives rise to the to the three-dimensional appearance of the world.
So they're more than the interpretation of the
I think there are sort of bolt-on. So in addition to having saying this is the real state, you also have to say what part of this corresponds to what we see. So it's sort of, I mean, it's a bit messy, I think, but it's something you have to add.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what one can take the strategy of saying, well, I also have to say what it is about the ontology that gives rise to what we see. It sort of relates to a sort of thing more generally that's called psychophysical parallelism. So you have to connect, you know, our conscious perceptions with some properties of your ontology. So I think that would be the way to think of this. I've not seen Girardi or Bell express it in those terms, but that would be one way to do it, that you have to identify what it is in the ontology, which can be some crazy thing, that corresponds to what you actually see. Yeah.
I think that makes sense.
exactly does that mean?
I
know what it means, but how does it relate to this?
So so when we have conscious perceptions, the conscious perceptions are of this part of the local variables.
Okay. The wave function doesn't say anything about your consciousness or what you will perceive, and so you have to add in some statement about what you will perceive when the wave function does a certain thing.
So then, how are variables different from observables? I mean, the way that we interact with wave functions through observables. So is that?
Well, observables are mathematical.
How do you relate to the physical reality, which is actually just the wave function?
Okay.
Yeah, and the observables are just mathematical objects that appear in quantum theory.
Okay. Yeah.
They're used for doing calculations, whereas this is a statement about ontology, about the way the world is.
Okay.
So the local variables question is much clearer in the context of the de Broglie-Bohm model, because then it's just the particle positions. So there it has a very clear story, whereas here it's not as clear because you don't have that.
Although in the de Broglie-Bohm case, couldn't you have initial conditions that in which the particle positions were not determined by the wave function?
So the particle positions always, the way they move is always determined by the wave function. But you can have it to be the case that the initial distribution is different from psi squared. That's true. But that doesn't affect this. This is just a question. You know, what is it? What are my conscious perceptions latch onto? There is a sort of a step. You can take it one step back from actually talking about consciousness, and you can say, well, I just want to account for the appearances of the world. I want to be able to take some property of the ontology and show that it looks like the world I imagine. It looks like the way I imagine the world is, so that we have tables and chairs. Even if I'm not in the room, there's tables and chairs and so on. I imagine that they're there. And can I find some function of the wave function that gives me something like that, something like a three-dimensional world? That's the way I imagine it be. So even without the consciousness story, you can still motivate this issue. okay, I better rush on because I want to actually get down the model. So the dynamics. So the the dynamics is that you have Schrodinger evolution except when jumps occur. And I'm about to tell you what jumps are. Did you have a question?
Well, kind of. If you say like Schrodinger evolution except when jumps occur.
Yeah. Well, the jumps are instantaneous. So.
Yeah.
So you always have Schrodinger evolution, but sometimes jumps occur. And
sure, that's going straight back to the reality. You have dynamic evolution, then you have a...
Oh, no, but this is now... This jump process I'm going to describe is part of the fundamental dynamics. Okay, so it's a modification to the fundamental dynamics, and the way we describe it is by introducing this jump process that happens probabilistically. So I'll give you the equations. Okay, so here's the jump process. And I'm taking all of this from Bell's paper because it's a sort of a simpler pedagogical presentation. The probability per unit time for having a jump. Is n over tau, where n is the number of particles, and tau is a new fundamental constant of nature. So you should think of this as the probability. If you multiply this by delta t, some small time, then it gives you the probability of having a jump during that very small time. And since it's multiplied by n, you can think of this as saying, well, the probability per particle is just is 1 over tau. But then you have n particles, so it becomes n over tau. The jump is this. So the wave function basically gets acted on by a jump operator. And then renormalized. So I'll explain. I'll write down a particular form for this that's suggested by GRW, and I'll write down what this is equal to as well. So n, so you can see this is acting on a particular one of the labels in this wave function, a particular one of the arguments corresponding to particle n. So an n is chosen randomly from 1 to n. Okay. So. Some amplitude weighting. Yeah, we'll come to that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's the next. I'll come to that. So when the other thing is you have to choose x as well, and I'll explain how x is chosen. And this jump function is normalized. And the choice that's given in the Girardi Rimini Weber paper is a Gaussian. So what's happening is you're multiplying your wave function in the randomly chosen coordinate, Rn, by a Gaussian and then renormalizing.
So A is the constant of nature also?
Yes, A is, yeah.
So they just postulated that such constants simply exist.
Yeah, so they say if you take this as a fundamental theory, then you just get these fundamental constants of nature. Now, if you were ever to try and derive a collapse model, such as this one, from some more fundamental considerations, like the considerations of D'Ossi and Penrose, then you might derive this fundamental constants of nature from some deeper considerations. But at this stage, we're just stating a particular model without trying to account for where the model comes from. Oh, and I should define the normalization. Constant. It is given by this. You just integrate over the wave function after the jump process. And now, the next point. So what we have here is we're choosing n randomly, but we're also choosing x randomly. X is the jump center. And that's chosen randomly as well. With this probability. Yes, stochastically, yeah.
Can you explain the difference?
So there's no deterministic equation which tells you where x is going to be chosen. It's just a random thing. This is sort of regarded as a fundamental random process. Sometimes randomness is the underlying process is deterministic. You just don't know what it is. Here, it's regarded as being fundamentally random. Is that what you meant by stochastically?
No, just that randomly, I would say, means equally or equally likely, whereas stochastically means probabilistic. So randomly does not seem like predictive.
Oh, okay, yeah, let's write stochastically. Right. Noticed in particular here that this R has the jump in it. So you're actually calculating what the wave function is going to be afterwards, and using that to determine the probability for a particular jump center. Okay.
This term here, should there be an integral, or should just be?
Well, this is equal to this. So there is an integral in here.
I mean, this is a probability for a certain x.
This is a probability for a certain x.
But yeah. Why is there an integral over x?
There isn't an integral over x.
And this term you're looking for
d3. Oh, sorry. So this is the probability density.
Okay.
And then if you think of this, if let's turn this into delta. So if you take a small volume, then this is the probability of x being in that small volume. Okay. Okay. So Girardi, Rimini, and Weber suggested 10 to the 8 years for tau. So this is a really big time, 100 million years, or 10 to the 15 seconds. And they suggested -5 centimeters for A. So for one particle, this jump process is happening very rarely.
Yep. Doesn't a jump radius on that parameter mean that like a sub like forks and stuff would be jumping probabilistically outside of where they would normally live?
So I don't know if anyone's ever applied it to quarks, but it is true that one of the tutorial questions is going to be to look at this. If you have a particle in the ground state, such as an atom in the ground state, and you hit it with this jump, then although this is much bigger than the size of an atom, it's not that much bigger. And so it will lead to a small probability of excitation of the atom. And then if you have enough atoms, if you have a mole of hydrogen atoms, say, initially in the ground state, then there'll be some probability, and then you start to get a reasonable rate of production of photons as these atoms de-excite. Yeah. So one of the things I should say about this is this model differs empirically from standard quantum theory. The other interpretations I gave you so far don't make different empirical predictions. So this is sort of both a strength and a weakness. It's a strength because if anyone discovers these processes, then the model is in some sense confirmed. But it's a weakness.
Well, in condensed matter, this is in fact the mesoscopic scale.
Right.
Where the quantum effects and main body theory become
important. Right. So, but then you have to actually apply this process to those models and see if the difference, if the predictions are actually different from what's been seen empirically. And so people have played around with that and looked at the parameter space and what's ruled out. There's a paper by Tomolka, somebody in Tomolka, looking at the parameter space and seeing what's ruled out by available experimental data. Of course, it's always possible you haven't taken into account enough experimental data. My understanding is that some version of this model is still plausible. I mean, maybe not quite these initial parameters that were proposed in 1986, but the model isn't ruled out. So these were just some numbers they chose, and they chose this to be smaller than you can perceive, sort of with the human eye, so to speak, and certainly small enough to do the job of making the pointer states collapse. I'll explain that in a moment. But big enough that it doesn't affect atoms in ground states and so on too much. Like if you made this much smaller, like if you made this comparable to the size of an atom, then you just get massive production of photons, and the model would become implausible. So there's a sort of delicate sort of balance between choosing these parameters so that they're they do the job you want them to do, and so that they don't disagree with the available empirical data.
One question. I think, so wait, what's that in meters? It's, I guess 10 to the minus 7 meters. Because that's getting pretty close to the size that we can resolve with very powerful microscopes.
Right, right.
But we don't see any superposition.
You've got to actually produce superposition at that scale to sort of show that this is too small.
No, but with current microscopes, you can see it's like to 15 nanometers.
Oh, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, but those microscopes aren't doing interference experiments.
Right, oh, I see.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, quite the opposite. They're scattering electrons or something off your system so that they would destroy any interference that was there already anyway. Yeah. So they don't pose an empirical challenge. So we discussed why this scale, And then this scale, you can see this is an enormous period of time for a single particle. But if you have, say roughly a mole of particles, then suddenly the collapses start to happen very frequently. So if your probability n over tau starts to become very big, and so the time scale at which this collapse happens is essentially much faster than we could perceive.
So you're choosing the Gaussian for jump operator.
Yeah.
Is that like a reasonable choice?
I mean, they had to make some choice, and so that was what they chose. I guess mathematically, it's nice.
Yeah. You get like Gaussian quantum mechanics, which is like a subtheory of full quantum.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know if that. I don't know what their motivation was. They may state it in the paper, but I don't remember. I mean, so you don't want to have something that's too sharp, because then it will really kick your systems into higher energy states. And you might as well have a function that's sort of mathematically nice, unless you have some fundamental reason for believing in a particular jump function. So that's what they chose there. So let me talk about how this model actually does the job it's supposed to do. So remember, I want to not do too much to perturb small systems, but to strongly perturb big systems. Okay, so here's a typical quantum experiment. You have a superposition. So a typical quantum interference experiment, let's say. So we could think of something like this, where we have a wave packet which is has two lumps in it, and let's imagine that they're separated by some distance which is much greater than a. But each wave packet is a width which is much smaller than a. So every 100 million years, roughly, this particle, a particle that is going to get hit by a Gaussian. So during the course of an interference experiment, this happens very rarely. I mean, if you do enough, you send enough particles through the interferometer, then a few of them will get hit. You send however long they spend inside the interferometer, probably a fraction of a second. So then you can work out how many of those are going to get hit for a big enough ensemble. But every so often, one of them will get hit, and this will go. Well, now it depends where the collapse center is. If the collapse center is over here, then it will kill this term. And if the collapse center is over here, it's going to kill this term, because you're multiplying this by a Gaussian. So what will happen is, in the case where the collapse center is over here, you keep this term. Oh, and this term gets bigger because of the renormalization.
Is the collapse center the same as the jump center?
The jump center, the jump center, sorry. So this is in the case where the jump center is over here. So the wave function goes to this. It gets renormalized. This shape is almost preserved because these wave packets are much narrower than the size of the Gaussian. There'll be a slight modification, but not very much. But this happens very, very rarely. And so interference is hardly affected. But now what happens during a measurement? So imagine we have some measurement. We send a particle in. We have a pointer initially. So there's some pointer on this apparatus. Initially, it's in a zero state. But then afterwards, the pointer either goes, as the particle comes out, the pointer either goes to the one state or the two state. So mathematically, you have some wave function so the sort of thing I've written down in previous lectures goes to something like this. So we can try to write this thing down here. This is a highly entangled state. We have lots of particles either in this position with the particle coming out in the A1 state or in this position. Excuse me. Take some water. Or in the other position. So the state is going to be something like, well, a certain, let me write it down in position representation. So a certain position, a particle, let me call the particle that comes in particle one. Something like this is just to give you the idea. All the particles in the pointer being either in some state. You can imagine them being roughly, the particles being roughly independent for each of these two positions inside the pointer. So you have in this pointer all the particles n equals 2 to n. And either they all correspond to being over here. So we call this 1. Or there's an alpha. All they correspond to. All being in another position. The state wouldn't actually be this. This is just sufficient to make the point I want to make. Probably the particles would actually be even more correlated than this because they'd be correlated inside the pointer. But this is a sort of rough model that we can use to make the point I want to make. It doesn't change. It doesn't change if you use a more realistic state. Is it clear what I'm saying here? So this is what we want is that a n. That the wave packets, the wave functions for each of these individual things in this big product state are essentially non-overlapping, which is going to be true because all the particles are either over here or over here in different places. So now, the probability of a hit, probability of a jump, is much bigger because we have n particles, and n is going to be roughly Avogadro's number. So the probability of a hit happening in some very small time interval is essentially one, or the rate at which these hits happen for the is very high, and if a hit happens, well, you can see. What's happening is when a hit does happen, it's just going to affect one particle. Which particle it is, we don't know in advance, because that's chosen at random. But one of these particles will be affected. And whichever particle it is, it's going to kill the other term. So if the hit happens for particle n, so imagine this is the A1 particle n, and this is the A2. Term, then if the jump center is over here, then it's going to kill this. So you'll have something that's basically just a left like this, left something that's left like that. But because this state is so entangled, that's also going to kill this entire term. Basically, it introduces a zero into this term, so it kills that entire term. You can think about it like this. If you have a crowd of people in a dark room, and either the whole crowd is on one side of the room, or the whole crowd is on the other side of the room, but you can't see the whole crowd, and then one person in the crowd sneezes, then you immediately know that the whole crowd is on the left or the right. You hear the sneeze. And so because these particles are so entangled, because the pointer, all the particles in the pointer are either in one place or the other, just a single jump is enough to collapse the entire macroscopic wave function. So that's the that's how macroscopic objects are affected very quickly. Is that clear? Yep. Good. Okay. I don't want to go on too much longer because I'm getting into lunchtime. I wanted to say something about the two different sort of local viewable ontologies. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow morning. And I also wanted to talk a bit about empirical predictions and so on. But I'll do some criticisms that have been leveled at the approach. But I'll do all that. I'll do that tomorrow.